Science Weekly, sponsored by the British Heart Foundation, whose Mending Broken Hearts appeal is funding groundbreaking research to find a way to repair heart muscle damaged as a result of a heart attack.
The Guardian.
Our entire life, from birth to death, is, if all goes well, a wonderful extended note, created by a remarkable instrument, in the complex orchestration that is the human body. That instrument is the heart. Hello, you're listening to a special edition of Science Weekly, all about the physiology, the chemistry, and the dynamics of the heart.
In our lifetime, which we expect these days to be at least 80 years, the heart will beat 3 billion times. That's 30 with 8 zeros after it. That's a big number.
Without putting a figure on it, I think people are taking food, they're drinking water, they're breathing air, and they're swallowing cardiovascular drugs.
I think as far as, you know, could we grow a heart in a dish is concerned, I mean, at the moment, I can't see a way that could ever be possible, I'll be honest with you. But then, never say never.
I'm Alok Jha, here with me to discuss and clarify how hearts work, how they go wrong, and how we might rebuild them in the future. I'm joined by this man.
Thank you. I'm Kevin Fong, and it's always difficult to know how best to describe myself. I'm a Wellcome Trust Engagement Fellow, but I'm a consultant anaesthetist at University College Hospital. I'm a space junkie, but for the purposes of this program, I'm someone who's become fascinated with the heart and everything it can do.
What is your fascination with the heart, Kevin?
I think the heart's evolved over the time that I've been learning about it. You know, from school, where it's just a set of schematic diagrams on the page, and then, you know, it evolves as you go to medical school into this thing that's a three-dimensional but inert object. You know, when you're sort of seeing the cadaveric versions in the dissection room, and then finally, as a doctor, you're seeing this dynamic organ, and as an anaesthetist, you eventually end up manipulating it, driving it, trying to carry it through in health and disease, and so. That's really where my interest lies.
Okay, well, let's start with some physiology. The heart is a muscle, we all know that, that has to beat without fail for your entire life. Because if it ever does fail, well, that would be disastrous. So, how does it beat? What causes the various bits to pump things in and out?
The heart's a really remarkable organ. It has to beat throughout our lifetime without pausing. And in our lifetime, which we expect these days to be at least 80 years, the heart will beat 3 billion times. That's 30 with 8 zeros after it. That's a big number. And that is true whether you're a mouse or whether you're an elephant or you're a man. It's about the same number of heartbeats. A mouse uses all its up in about 2 years. It has a heart rate of about 600. An elephant, much larger animal, has a much slower heart rate and lives for much longer. And so it's a very interesting quirk of nature that the number of heartbeats in a lifetime seems approximately constant. This is not really a feature of the way our heart works. It's really more a feature of the metabolic demands of our tissues, of our body. That is, small animals like mice, they have a very high metabolic demand, and therefore they need a high heart rate. And they tend to burn out quicker because of the high metabolic demand. Whereas much larger animals, like a whale or an elephant, their heart rate is lower because their metabolic demands are lower.
That was Professor Michael Shattuck of the Rain Institute at the King's College London there. Kev, tell us your professional relationship with Mike. How do you know him?
Mike and I met because we have a mutual interest in extreme environment physiology. I give some lectures on his course at King's College, his undergraduate lecture course in extreme environments. But in that time, I've sort of come to appreciate the work that he does in investigating the heart as a scientist. And he has a beautiful and elegant understanding of you know, the fractal beauty and the complexity of that organ.
I mean, he's interested, as you said, in the heart as an object of science, what it's capable of, how it beats. He mentioned earlier 3 billion heartbeats in one lifetime, which is a huge amount, 12,000 odd every day. And so when I spoke to him, I asked him just to break it down. Let's talk about one single beat.
Now, the way in which the heartbeat arises is that there is a specialist region in the top of the heart called the pacemaker. So once the electrical excitation arises in the pacemaker region, which is at the top of the heart, it then spreads down through the top chambers of the heart, the atria, and spreads down towards a specialist part of the heart called the atrioventricular node, or the AV node. Now that special part of the heart then rapidly conducts that electrical impulse down the heart to the apex, or the point of the heart, and then that electrical impulse spreads up to the chambers, to the muscle pumping chambers of the heart itself. So the way in which the electrical conduction system of the heart is arranged, the wiring of the heart is arranged, is very efficiently coordinated. So the top of the heart, the atria, contract first, expelling blood into through the valves and into the ventricles, and then the ventricles themselves contract from the apex, not from the top of the heart, the base of the heart, but from the apex of the heart, pushing blood up towards the outflow tracts and towards the systemic circulation.
So the heart is in the middle of a cycle. It's the centre of a physiological loop that pumps blood all around our bodies. Kev, give us an indication of how much blood is going round. How hard is the heart working?
Well, for a healthy individual, you or I, you know, around about 70 kilograms or so, there's about 5 litres going around every minute, about 70 mils in every heartbeat. And that's at rest sitting here. When you start exercising, it has a tremendous capacity to increase that output, and it can sort of get up to, I don't know, about, it should be able to get up to about 4 or 5 times that.
Well, let me remind you of a particularly, well, let's not say embarrassing episode. You made a film earlier this year, Horizon, on all about the heart, and you had to go up against some rowers. How did that go?
Yeah, that was embarrassing, I think.
I didn't want to say that. But
well, I mean, there's that terrible moment where we all walk through the door together and I'm flanked by these two rows, and you have that... Is Kev standing a lot further away from the camera than they are?
No, he's just very small.
I mean, they're just huge. It just feels wrong. It feels wrong standing next to them. They're just these mountain-type people. And then the embarrassment continued. You get on the rowing machine, and they're just flicking through these ergos, these rowing machines, you know, just cruising along, literally not even breaking sweat. And while they're doing that, I'm trying to match that, and I'm at full tilt, and I managed that for, I don't know, less than a minute before I just had to lie down and feel like I wanted to die. And at top whack, my heart was putting out something like between 15 and 20 litres a minute. So that's me at absolute peak performance, chucking out, you know, about 3 to 4 times what I am at rest. And then they got these guys on to do their final sort of few metres of the sprint, as if they were going for gold in the Olympics. And they dragged them off these machines and stuck an echocardiogram probe on their chests to try and image the hearts in that moment when they were really working at top whack. And they were chucking out 45 litres a minute. And you just have to picture that in your head. You know, think about it. If you're in the supermarket and you're looking at litre cartons of milk stacked on the shelf, and then imagine 45 of those being cleared off the shelf by this pump every minute. And that's what the heart at its peak performance is capable of.
I mean, that's an incredible amount of liquid. It's an incredible amount of just effort going on there. And these guys are... It's not like they have anything particularly special beyond training, is it? I mean, what is it that's allowing them to do something like that?
It's difficult to know precisely what it is that underlies the absolute peaks of performance, what makes a gold medalist and distinguishes them from someone who's just very good at it. There is some physicality to it. I mean, these guys are just bigger than the rest of us. They have, it's not just their hearts, it's also their lungs. But they have to have the volition, the will to train in the way that they do. They have to have that discipline. And they are physiologically absurd. I mean, on top of that massive volume that they chuck out, their cardiologist tells me that at rest, or when they're asleep, they reckon that their heart rates might be in their 20s.
So let's leave those super hearts behind slightly and go back to the fascinating detail of a normal heartbeat. Now, Kevin, if I was to ask you the connection between London Water and frogs' hearts as an important bit of cardiac history, would you know what I'm talking about?
I'm about to be very embarrassed, I think, because I think I should know this story because I think it originates from my university, but no, I'm not sure I do.
Well, in that case, you need to listen to Mike again. Here's Mike Shattuck on a serendipitous discovery.
Sydney Ringer, working just across the river from where we're standing now at University College, made a really key observation. What he noticed was really serendipitous. He noticed it like all good scientific discoveries by accident. He was doing some experiments working on beating frog hearts, which were being kept alive by saline solutions. In fact, we get the name Ringer's solution, of course, from his experiments. What Sydney Ringer did was he went into the lab one day to do some experiments because his technician was away on holiday or was off for some reason. And Sydney found that the hearts that he perfused in the laboratory would not beat. And he didn't understand what was going on. And so when his technician came back, he said to his technician, "What is it that you do that I don't do that allow these hearts to beat?" And his technician said, "Well, I know you told me to use distilled water to make up my solutions. Well, actually, I use tap water." Sydney Ringer then went away and analysed what was in the tap water feeding University College. And he found it was chock-a-block full of calcium. It's very hard water feeding London, and it was full of calcium. And he realised it was calcium that was critical for the beating of the heart.
Kevin, we've talked there about how the heart is a mechanical object that's pumping stuff around, but also it's a place of delicate chemistry.
Well, I mean, and that's the mistake, is to think about the heart, to conceptualise it as simply a mechanical pump, which we did for a long time. But Mike's work is really about the layer underneath that, that this sort of beautiful flux of ions across membranes that provides this electrical current that couples to the underlying musculature and allows it to beat, but not just beat in any old fashion, beat in a rhythmic fashion, reliably beat to beat, allowing fluid to flow, blood to flow across its surfaces and through those valves, 72 beats a minute, 24 hours a day, every year of your life until you die.
We talked earlier about the rowers' superhearts, but can you talk a bit more about the other extremes that scientists are working out that the heart can actually manage to survive under?
Well, this is the other remarkable thing, I think, about the heart, is once you begin to appreciate that complexity that underlies it and how subtle some of those mechanisms are, you then start to consider it in disease, and you begin to appreciate simultaneously how fragile it is, but also how it is capable of exhibiting resilience. And there are some incredible examples of this in history, and the one that I've most recently come into contact with is the case of Anna Bagenholm, a Norwegian skier who had a horrible accident just over 10 years ago now, where she fell into an ice-cold stream, smashed through some ice, found herself freezing, literally freezing to death in this stream, underwent cardiac arrest, her heart stopped, and she was an hour from the nearest hospital by air. They couldn't get her out from underneath the ice. Her heart was suspended, so she was without any heartbeat for hours. I think it's possibly up to well over 2 hours, possibly 3 hours. And her core temperature went down to just over 13 degrees centigrade, so close to a third of what your normal core temperature should be. And there you're looking at someone who should die in that moment, colder than anyone's ever been before and survived, longer without a heartbeat than any adult, nearly any adult in recorded history, and in the middle of some snowy wasteland in Norway. And yet she does survive. And not only does she survive, but she goes on to qualify and become a doctor in the hospital that saved her life.
What does knowing about those sorts of extremes help you with as a doctor? I mean, why would you want to know that the heart could survive something like that?
Well, I think her case is about pushing the boundaries and about knowing what the limits of life are and when it's worth continuing. You know, when is it okay to stop? When actually there's something salvageable there. And Anna's case redrew the boundaries for a lot of people of what was worth continuing with. I mean, her story exists in legend in the medical fraternity. You know, people know something of her story. They may be familiar with not the detail of it, but the case itself. But confronted with the facts of it, it's just even more compelling. You look at the biochemistry. There's a paper published in The Lancet about this case. And you look at the biochemistry, and it's inescapable, the conclusion, when you're looking at that biochemistry, that it's the biochemistry of a dead person. And yet, she is resuscitated, and not to just some horribly disabled future. She's resuscitated to becoming a very successful professional, as well as a very, very lovely person when you meet her.
Well, so far we've been exploring the beauty of the functioning heart, but this vital organ can and does break. And when it does break, it can be dramatic.
My magazine again?
What are you talking about? I'm a sick man, eh?
Rubbish, you've been in here 10 weeks now, and I can still find nothing basically wrong with you.
Can I open if you've done your job?
It's ridiculous. And with the temperature 106, you're dead.
Well, don't just stand there. Bury me.
It's certainly a very puzzling case, Doctor.
It's an enigma. That's what it is, Matron. An enigma.
I am not having another one of those.
The actor Sid James made millions of people laugh with his very unpolitically correct characters in the Carry On films. But his final laugh was for a cataclysmic fatal heart attack on stage in Doncaster in 1976. His fellow actors called for someone to help Sid after his collapse. They screamed for a doctor, but the audience just carried on laughing.
Well, there's a number of different conditions that can occur with respect to heart injury, one of which is an acute condition called myocardial infarction. That's effectively a heart attack. That occurs due to a blockage of the coronary artery, build-up of lipids and a plaque formation that blocks the artery, and below that then muscle and the blood vessel cells die. And that's basically a very acute injury setting. There's also sudden cardiac death, which occurs due to a collapse of the conduction of electricity through the heart. So for a number of different reasons, the actual rhythmic contraction of the heart is disturbed. And ultimately, if it's disturbed at a level that's basically catastrophic, the heart will just stop beating. And in fact, the individual will drop down dead. And there's been a number of high-profile cases of that, particularly in sports, people who push their hearts to a limit. And if they have this underlying condition, then they die. There's also chronic, sort of more chronic conditions, heart failure, which actually are brought about by small bouts of myocardial infarction, i.e. the patient will survive those attacks, or even long-term hypertension and angina, and the heart will slowly remodel. And what it does there is basically expands in size. The walls often get thinner in an attempt to compensate, to need to contract more. And over time, that heart will actually remodel itself, whereby its efficiency is massively reduced. And the chronic endpoint is that the heart will fail.
That was Professor Paul Riley, a molecular cardiologist based at the University of Oxford. He was giving us a very sobering overview there of the most common ways in which our hearts can malfunction, the ways they can break. We'll hear more from Paul about his cutting-edge regenerative research a little later. But Kevin, I'm assuming that the prevalence of the kinds of fatal heart conditions that were around when the late Sid James died in the 1970s, they've changed in the intervening decades.
I mean, the epidemiology of heart disease has transformed since that time. I mean, it's transformed even since the time that I've been a qualified doctor. That's close on 15 years now. When I was wandering around the wards as a newly qualified doctor, as a house officer, the way we dealt with heart attacks, the things that we did, was very different from the way they do it today. And I remember sort of fondly those many, many long hours traipsing around after consultants, and one in particular, Professor Raymond McAllister, who you know, you'd be out there on the wardrobe looking after people who'd come in with heart conditions the night before. And I was interested to talk to him about how much it's changed since he was a house officer.
Well, the big change, Kevin, is that there are fewer patients coming to hospital with big heart attacks. So it wasn't uncommon when I was your age and younger to be seeing young men of 30 and 40 with big heart attacks coming into hospital. They'd survive, some wouldn't, but even those that survived would have permanent heart damage, and life's very different after they left hospital. And these days, that is just a much less common event. So we see heart attacks, but they're small. And we see heart attacks, but they're occurring in individuals much older.
Just give me a sense for the numbers involved here, because this is still the disease that kills the most people in this country, in the Western world. How many people are dying of this yearly now compared to...
So, when you were a Huisman, it was about 125,000 a year in England and Wales. Last year, it was about 30,000. So, big reduction.
Huge. Mm.
Hello! So, you're here to find out what it's like to have a heart attack. Well, we don't have much time because with heart attacks you'd never do. Well, let's start with the first symptom most people think of. Yes, chest pains. Well,
public campaigns have clearly succeeded in making us aware of heart disease, such as this dramatic and shocking advert by the British Heart Foundation from 2008, starring the actor Stephen Berkoff. And as Professor McAllister's already pointed out, there's been a radical drop in the number of classic coronaries. Kevin, how has this happened?
Well, it's actually a very complicated picture, because it's a combination of lifestyle and drugs and other interventions. I mean, the lion's share of it probably is lifestyle. We smoke less, we eat a bit better, we do more exercise, we listened to those health campaigns and it saved our lives. But there's still a pretty impressive fraction that's down to just drugs and the way that we use drugs now and the way that drugs have modified that disease. And I'd say that it maybe not quite half the variation that we see, but probably about 40% is because of drugs alone.
I would say most people over the age of 60 should be on a statin. We're a planet now of 7 billion human beings. There's probably 1 billion individuals with raised blood pressure in need of some form of treatment, whether it be a lifestyle advice or drug therapy. So, without putting a figure on it, I think people are taking food, they're drinking water, they're breathing air, and they're swallowing cardiovascular drugs.
Professor Raymond McAllister there talking about the ubiquity of cardiovascular drugs. Why have they been so successful?
Well, I think early on it was recognised that you might modify this disease by manipulating physiology. In particular, it was very early on realised that if you reduced blood pressure, that might help. And then lowering certain types of cholesterol was also found to be advantageous. But you know, 15 years ago, there was an element of cookery to how we gave those that cocktail of drugs. But, you know, this changed with the advent of an evidence-based approach to that literature. And in some ways, coronary heart disease was the perfect vehicle to allow evidence-based medicine to gain some traction. It's this population-wide disease, huge numbers involved, with a very, very hard endpoint, relatively simple interventions in the way of pills for you to chart whether or not you're making any progress against it. And so some of the best-known randomized controlled double-blind trials that existed that showed benefit, that guided the way that we practice medicine in an area, were all from coronary heart disease studies.
It's clearly been very, very successful, but there are still challenges.
Oh, there are huge challenges. And what you've done is taken one disease entity, coronary heart disease, and replaced it, for which the incidence has gone down massively. You've replaced it with a new problem, which is people who are living on, surviving the initial heart attack, but with hearts that are failing, literally failing. They're failing to deliver the requirements of the rest of the body. So that's an entity we call heart failure. And those numbers are skyrocketing. And so you're left now with a situation in which survival isn't your goal. It's not the only goal. It's survival and it's life. It's having a livable life afterwards. And that's the new challenge.
At the moment, the only cure is for a sort of heart attack, myocardial infarction, even, you know, moving towards heart failure, is heart transplantation. That's the only viable cure. Comes with an awful lot of caveats and problems associated. Include, you know, the main one is there aren't enough hearts, donor hearts available. And then the second big problem is if you do have a heart transplant, you're likely to have immune rejection of the organ, and so therefore you've got to be on strong immune suppressive drugs for the rest of your life, and that's actually a problematic with side effects and it, you know, the quality of life obviously it's better than having a damaged heart, but it still causes problems. So surgery is the only cure. There are interventional drugs to ease some of the prognosis and the problems, but ultimately what we really want to try and do is repair the area of damage.
Professor Paul Riley there being very realistic about the reliance on surgery and immune suppression. But as he points out, what we really want to do is repair damaged hearts, mend the broken heart. And he and colleagues in Oxford are beginning to come up with ideas on ways to do just that.
So our work really came about through developmental biology. We were very interested in how the heart is formed, and we were interested in how the epicardial cells can give rise to the coronary blood vessels and potentially to the heart muscle. And what we did was basically we identified that these cells still exist in the adult heart, but they're effectively inactive, they're effectively dormant. So from early stages after birth, they switch off their activity. It's now known that they may actually contribute a low number of cells during heart function over a lifetime, and that's actually being explored in detail as we speak by us and other groups. But the important point was they were dormant, they were effectively asleep. And what we did was we wanted to reactivate those cells, and we wanted a measure of how we had reactivated them. And the key point there was we needed some means to label these cells. So we used a mouse model whereby we had a transgenic mouse which had a green fluorescent protein driven by a particular gene. And this gene is switched on during development in these cells but switched off in the adult. So what we thought is if we use a mechanism to stimulate these cells, this gene will be switched back on, turn the cells green, and we can follow what they do. And now means to reactivate them was this protein called thymosin beta-4 plus the actual injury event itself. So we treated animals with thymosin beta-4, which is a small peptide known to stimulate cell movement and has been shown to sort of reactivate potentially these cells. And we injured the animals at the same time. So a combination of pre-treatment with thymosin beta-4, injury, giving the animals an infarction, a myocardial infarction, combined, enabled us to watch what these cells did. They turned on this green fluorescent protein. They then migrated into the area of injury, and they formed smooth muscle cells, fibroblasts, and also cardiomyocytes, the muscle of the heart. So we were basically able to track them through this whole mechanism of reactivating an embryonic gene program.
So Paul Riley there has an interesting way of tracking what he's doing to the heart cells.
I mean, it's a very interesting method to use. I mean, he's taking stuff that we now sort of take for granted, but in and of itself is quite remarkable, using molecular biology to take these cells, engineer them so that they fluoresce when they're reactivated, at least if I understand the method correctly. And then he's then got these heart cells that fluoresce when they reactivate, and now he's got something that he can test his intervention on. So he can injure those cells and then apply his intervention and track what happens.
Well, let's hear him talking about that particular step in his research.
The process by which we believe the improved function, if you like, that we were able to measure in these animals was a combination of events. The first event is there is an improved survival of the existing cells in the damaged area. And that's actually a function that's attributed to thymosin beta-4 itself. It's able to do that. So that's one of its functions outside of stimulating epicardial cells. Secondly, the epicardial cells, once activated, get into the area of injury. They replace the dead and dying cells. So in the area of direct injury, where the blood vessel has been occluded and there's been death, you cannot repopulate that area with the existing cell types. Instead, these epicardial cells have to migrate in and actually start to contribute new cells in that region. So the main problem, though, with that is that there's already a lot of scarring have occurred, which is the natural process called fibrosis and laying down collagen to patch up the area of injury. And that's an inhospitable environment for new cells to migrate into. So basically what the cells do is they kind of park themselves around the outside of the injury and start to make blood vessels and muscle. What we really need to do now is to understand how to dial down that fibrosis and scarring at the same time as stimulating these epicardial cells to migrate in. So it's a balancing act between preventing the degree of scarring that occurs getting the cells in the right area to regenerate and repair, but at the same time not preventing scarring so much so that we, if you like, remove the elastoplast over the area of injury and the heart ruptures, because that's its patch. It's you know, that's the mechanism by which the human adult heart and the mammalian adult heart in general is able to sort of patch up an area of injury. And if you take that away and you don't have a solid regenerative response, the heart is likely to rupture.
So he's watched these epicardial cells turn into new tissue that potentially could repair damage. But obviously it's just a first step.
It's a first step, but an important step against a formidable problem. You know, heart failure can't be underestimated. It's not like, oh, I had a heart attack, but I'm still alive, and that's all right, at least I'm alive. I mean, some people are utterly disabled by this. I mean, if you imagine that the heart is sort of the, you know, it is the, your powerhouse, it's the seat at which you, from which you deliver oxygen to the rest of your body, and if that's not working, then you're limited in what you can do. If your heart no longer has that dynamic range, if it can't step up when you want to step up, then you know, you may well be wheelchair bound. And so this is the new war. This is how to take people disabled by heart failure as a result of heart disease and heart attacks and return them to something that looks like what they were before.
So let's put what Paul Reilly's been up to into context with the other frontiers in regenerative medicine when it comes to cardiac science. What other things are going on that you think are particularly exciting?
Well, there's a lot of approaches to this, and that kind of tells you something about the scale of the problem. Paul Reilly's group are taking quite a nuanced approach to it. They're trying to use tricks that the body sort of has but's forgotten to repair and restore hearts. Other people are more radical. Either they use mechanical devices to augment the heart, and we've seen some new what people call total artificial hearts, which approach that holy grail but aren't quite there yet. There are some of those out there in use, a handful. And then also there are some very, very exciting areas of work with stem cells being used in a very absolute way to regrow a heart from scratch that's compatible with your physiology and your immunology. And then to replace that, basically to give yourself a heart transplant that comes from your own cells.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, that in itself is not quite possible yet, but there's some interesting work coming out of Spain. Just describe what Doris Taylor's been up to.
Doris Taylor is engaged in some very interesting work. She's based at the University of Minnesota, but she's collaborating with a group in Madrid. Part of the reason she's doing that is because Spain has such a brilliant system of organ donation and understands the scale of the problem and is pretty gung-ho about wanting to prosecute this type of research. And she's looking at taking a heart, perhaps either a cadaveric heart from a human or a pig's heart, removing the cellular structure of it, the muscle and all of the cells from around the underlying connective tissue framework, the scaffolding, if you like, of the heart, and then introducing stem cells from the person who needs the heart transplant and regrowing a heart from scratch. Now that sounds like science fiction, total science fiction, but she's had success at the level of rat hearts. She's taken rat hearts and done exactly that. So she's taken rat hearts, used detergent, a form of detergent, to remove the muscle cells and all the other cells from around the scaffolding, which leaves you this, what she calls, a ghost heart. And it really does look like a heart, you know, this pale ultrastructure underneath it is left there. And then she washes stem cells in over this. She grows a new heart on top of this scaffold, and it beats again. She makes it beat again, and she trains it to beat physiologically. And it's remarkable. She's done that. And the next goal for her is to try and achieve that with a human heart.
Now, did you think that this, something like this would have been possible when you started, you know, working in medicine?
No, I think that's the interesting thing about medicine is, especially when you're practicing medicine, if you're not a scientist, you're sort of so consumed in the moment in delivering healthcare that it's very hard to stop and stare and to look at what's on the horizon and know what's coming next and what's going to be the transformative thing? And I know, I mean, that wouldn't have been where I thought it was going. I thought it was going for better drugs and perhaps some better mechanical devices. The stem cells were, you know, just a rumour of something special in the future when I started.
So our understanding of how we mend a broken heart is expanding rapidly and new treatments are on the horizon. But here's what you've probably wanted to know from the beginning of this programme. Will we ever be able to grow a heart from scratch? Well, let's give the last word on this idea to a man who's at the forefront of this sort of research. Here's what Paul Riley thinks about whether we can grow a heart from scratch.
I think as far as, you know, could we grow a heart in a dish is concerned, I mean, at the moment, I can't see a way that could ever be possible, I'll be honest with you. But then, you know, never say never, because the developments and technologies and the three-dimensional culture systems that are in place now and our understanding of how these cells are put together in a three-dimensional context is growing exponentially. I think what will be possible, and in fact is ongoing, and is another area of very interesting research, is the ability to build a patch, to make a patch where you can layer on muscle, blood vessels, etc., and actually patch up the area of damage. And in fact, what people have shown in rodent models is that those patches can integrate very nicely with the existing tissue, and in fact start to contract in unison completely as they should do, at the right frequency, etc., with the surviving muscle. And so that sort of approach where, you know, again, tissue engineering to make a patch to cover an area of injury is another very exciting area of pursuit. And that can be done in culture, and they can be lifted off temperature-sensitive plates and literally popped on the area of damage. The issues there, of course, are having what we call self-tissue, so that it's from the patient themselves, so it's not rejected. Otherwise, you have the same problems with rejection that you have with heart transplantation. And so there are issues then of getting a patient's own stem cells, whether they can be reprogrammed stem cells, induced pluripotent stem cells, made into cardiac muscle, made into blood vessels, then made into one of these patches, then used for repair. That's perfectly feasible. And even in today's climate of the way this research is going, I could see that happening. But as for building a complete heart, that's some way off.
This special edition of Science Weekly was made with the support of the British Heart Foundation. Through November and December, we're hosting a series of in-depth interviews by experts in the field, some of whom you'll have heard in this programme. To watch the videos, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. I'm Alok Jha, and my co-presenter was Kevin Fong. This podcast was produced by Jason Phipps and features music specially composed for this podcast by Pascal Wise.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.